Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our nice guest is Yael Ben-David, a UX writer and thought leader, and we're going to talk about microcopy today. This episode is brought to you by Light Matter. Light Matter helps some of the world's fastest growing companies design and develop their software applications. Whether you don't yet need an in-house engineering team, or you're busy growing the next unicorn and can't hire fast enough, there is an immense value in working with a group of experts like Light Matter. Check them out at lightmatter.com/UIbreakfast to learn more. Hi, Yael.
Hi.
We're very excited to have you on board today.
I'm thrilled to be here.
So we had one episode with Yuval Keshtekar here, and then you reached out saying there is so much more to be said on the topic, and you actually wrote an amazing article, which, can you remind us, says something like a transcript of an interview I've never had.
Exactly. I'm a huge fan of your podcast, and I've been listening to it for a long time, and I'd never heard you speak with a UX writer or really even about UX writing. And when I saw that you were speaking to Yuval, I was really excited, and I listened to it right away, and I said, wow, I really would have loved to be part of a conversation like that. And so I got to work, I listened to it on my commute, and I sort of replayed it, wrote down the questions you'd asked, typed up what I would have said, and tagged you and hoped you'd see it and hoped you'd like it. And even on paper, it was a fun interview to do.
Well, I'm sure UX writing, it's not like an industry that you can fit into a 30-minute podcast episode, for sure.
Of course not.
So I'm really happy to have you today and ask the remaining questions and focus on the other aspect of it. Before we get started, could you share a bit more about where you come from? You have a pretty fascinating life story, so share a few moments for that.
Basically, I was trying to decide what I should study in college and wanted to do something that I loved, but also would be good at. And my mom and I made a list, and writing was on both. So we said, okay, how can I make a living writing? And we figured it wouldn't be novels or a syndicated column from the beginning. And we figured journalism was a job of writing. I studied journalism at NYU and really loved it, but I had a hard time when it came to the actual practice of journalism. First of all, I preferred the writing a lot more to the reporting. And I decided to look for something else, but I wasn't sure what. So I sort of made fate my partner and sent my resume out to literally anything I could find. I was still in New York City at the time. I even found out that you can apply to the FBI and the CIA online. So I did. Never heard back from them. But I did hear back from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, which is an unbelievable institution. It's the top cancer center in the world. And I started to work with a medical oncologist who I'm still in touch with today. And I said, wow, I want to do medicine, but I prefer to do research than clinical medicine. In the meantime, I moved to Israel, which is something I had decided to do when I was 14 and finally made it happen when I was 22. So I moved to Israel and I went to graduate school for neurobiology. And after a master's and PhD, decided I didn't really think I wanted to work in that either. But at this point, I had sort of created this unique combination, this unique skill set of working with complex concepts and also communicating them clearly to broad audiences in writing. So I decided that that's probably the direction I wanted to take next. And I got a job working at MyHeritage, which is a high-tech company in Israel with a genetics product. And I'd come from a genetics lab. And so doing product writing. At the beginning, it was marketing writing and also product writing. And then I began to specialize in UX writing there. Really seemed to make a good use of my skills. And I fell in love with it and decided that that's where I wanted to be. So right now I'm at a fintech company writing for a financial product. But this idea of combining the writing in a way that's very clear and speaks to broad audiences and simplifies complex concepts without losing the value, without dumbing it down, but rather making it more accessible. So that's really where I found my place.
How long ago has it been that you focused on UX writing specifically, since you've been putting out some nice articles on the topic and also kind of established yourself as a thought leader in this industry?
It's probably been just over 2 years. It actually hasn't been very long, and I didn't necessarily expect to become a thought leader. I think what happened was I started to get involved once I realized that this is what I wanted to do. I started joining forums and Facebook groups and attending local meetups and conferences, and almost just to process my own thoughts, I started writing it up on a Medium blog and tweeting that link out on Twitter. And I'd never been active on Medium or Twitter before this. And I guess people liked what I had to say and started following me. And I got into some really interesting conversations and was able to sort of cyber meet real thought leaders and become a part of the conversation. And I think part of that was I did a lot of what I do at work, which is a lot of research and speaking to a lot of stakeholders and getting a lot of opinions and then sort of synthesizing them into something very digestible. And people liked that. And also adding some of my own thoughts from my own experience. The thing about working in such a young industry is that there are a lot of people who want to break into it. And so people are sort of looking for that entry point, that sort of 101. What is it? How exactly might I fit into it? How do I prepare myself to enter this field? And so I tried to provide a lot of that with, you know, stories from the trenches. John Sato is actually a UX writer at Dropbox, who I really admire because in that sense, his articles very much talk about day in the life, and they're very relatable in that way. I definitely recommend them.
That's great that you essentially preceded my question, which was, now that you're sharing 101 articles, what was that 101 information that inspired you in your early days as a UX writer?
A lot of discussions. At first, it was more broad discussions. So what does a UX writer do? What are our responsibilities? Again, it's a relatively young field. And even if you look at the job description, sometimes the hiring manager doesn't even know what they're looking for. I've been on interviews where I kind of told them what they should want from me. And if I don't take the job, then what they should be looking for in the next candidate, because we're all sort of trying to figure it out together. So I did a lot of reading what opinions were and sort of consolidating them into a consensus of, okay, it seems to me like this is what a UX writer should do. This is what a UX writer does in a larger organization, in a smaller organization, things like that. Similarly, there was a lot of discussion. There still is a lot of discussion about titles. So are we UX writers? Are we content designers? Are we content strategists? And again, I did sort of like a survey of the field and spoke to people and read what was out there and listened to what I could and tried to summarize it, but also added my own opinion, which is essentially at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what you call yourself, it matters what you do. And standardization in that sense and in many others might be valuable in the future, but for now, we should probably reallocate the energy we're spending on discussing our titles to doing our work and proving our worth.
The UX design itself has not arrived to the terms 100% either. So I guess it's totally fine because there are so many sub-disciplines of that as well as the same way for writers. Do you find yourself doing some consulting gigs on the side, or do you typically work with your like full-time job environment?
I really focus on my full-time job because like any other job in high tech, and especially I'm sure as you know, when you have a family, it really does take up all of your bandwidth. I'd say the only consulting project I have right now is for my husband. He's the head of product at a very interesting product. It's a cryptocurrency app. And so he has that very specific need for clear copy on a very complex concept. So I have a lot of fun helping him with that. But no, I'm not freelancing at the same time.
Then my question would be, you're working for, I assume, a mature product. So how much work is there to be done on a daily basis? And we're not talking actual content, but mostly, you know, the copy that happens within the UX. How often do you revisit that in a mature product?
So that's actually a really good question. And you asked me at a really good time for me to give you an interesting answer. If you'd asked it any other time, I would say, I'm really glad you asked because a lot of people don't realize how much there is for UX writer to do. They say, look, you have, you know, it's micro copy, it's micro. There are 10 words on the page, a button and a link. What do you do all day? So the answer is, mature products are also, if they're successful, they tend to always be adding features. So you always have PMs. You know, at my last company, there were about 10 PMs and 10 designers to one of me. And they were constantly putting out features and things that needed copy. Now I have about 6 PMs who all come to me. So there are those ongoing features. Then, like you mentioned, there's revisiting existing copy, running tests, A/B tests. Also, it's not only the words on the screen, right? It's also transactional emails and even...
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so that's a lot. Right now, I'm responsible for the copy in about 200 emails, as well as the entire product. And also companies like ours and others have more than one product. So there's that. We're also responsible for the style guide for the voice and tone, which is a whole other subject I hope we'll get to. And on top of everything else, the reason that I am particularly glad you asked right now is because Funbox, where I am now, is actually going through a rebrand. So in addition to a visual rebrand, we're also doing an overhaul of the voice and tone. And this was a fascinating experience and valuable experience for me personally and the company, where we really did some serious introspection and workshopping and came up with what our guidelines for what our new voice and tone is going to be like and what the implementation of that means. I'm rewriting from scratch, essentially, all 200 emails, every screen of every product. And that includes, you know, obviously the happy flow, error states, empty states, one-time pop-ups that you'll only see if you got an email offering you a specific coupon. Really, really everything. So yeah, that's a huge project that's happening now. And it's a lot of writing microcopy.
You mentioned that voice and tone is a starting point. So the voice and tone for your current project, the new one, is it an open document anywhere that you could share? Or is it just open to all team members within the company?
I hope eventually there will be an external and an internal version, because there are different needs. So somewhere I'm looking as a model for an external version would be MailChimp. I love the format and the content of the MailChimp style guide that anyone can access if you just do a Google search.
But we'll link to that in the show notes.
Please do. It is a great sort of gold standard for anyone working on something similar. To me, as a UX writer, can't possibly be the only documentation they have. It's too high level. So my goal at the end of the day is to have a similar model. Right now, it's a work in progress. I'd say it's about 80% complete, but it's impossible to complete it first and then to start writing because it's very dynamic and you learn and, you know, it's 200 emails. I write 20 and by the 20th, I'm doing a better job than I was at the first. And by the 200th, I'm doing a better job than I was at the 50th. And better means a lot of different things, but let's just take it at face value that I end up going backwards a lot and updating the first emails I wrote to be more similar to later emails I wrote. And then throughout that process of bouncing my drafts off stakeholders and even running user tests and things like that, ending up and making changes to the style guide. So at this point, it's not there. It's about 80%. By the end of this rebrand, I'd say, I would hope it would be about 95% there. And at that point, I'd be able to publish an internal version. And I also plan to run training to, you know, one person can't and shouldn't be writing all of the user-facing copy because that would include support macros, right? The email templates that support sends to users, sales scripts, what they say on the phone to users, you know, and they're going to have to be a lot of people across the company writing user-facing communications. So I, in cooperation with the writers on the marketing team, will be training people across the company who are responsible for copy in their own departments and their own specialties and how to align to the style guide. And I expect, I hope, and I will encourage all of those people who have their hand in it to give me feedback. And of course, regardless, we'll continue to run tests with users. And it'll be updated all the time. So it's not something that's ever meant to be 100%.
So could you give us a brief overview of your best definition of voice and tone guide for a company? And if our listeners are, they represent smaller companies and they would love to hear, have a similar document for themselves, what is the best way to approach this task? Like, what's the best format to have it for a smaller company?
So voice is the personality of your brand. It's if your brand, if your product was a person, what would they sound like? Are they an introvert? Are they a class clown? Are they serious most of the time? Are they soft-spoken? Are they more like a librarian, like your accountant, like your doctor? Or are they more like the stand-up comedian you paid front row seats to see? So that's the first question you want to answer. That's your voice, is your personality. Your tone is how you adjust your voice to different situations. So for example, you might expect your doctor to be serious, but if you tell them a joke, you'd like to hear them laugh. Similarly, your voice needs to stay the same in your product, but your tone will shift if it's an error state or a point of friction, as opposed to being, I'll give you an example from my product. I work on a financial product, Fundbox. We extend credit to small businesses in the U.S., and if you're approved for credit, that first notification that you've been approved is a high moment. So we don't want to step out of our personality and suddenly sound like someone else who we're not, but we do want to, within who we are, have a very excited tone. Whereas if we've decreased your credit line, we need to sound empathetic by changing that tone and not sounding excited. It's not exciting for the user that we've decreased their credit limit. So we have to just sort of be attuned to how to adjust. And it's the same thing in real life, right? If you met somebody at a party and they seem to have a personality disorder because sometimes they had one personality and sometimes a different personality, it's not someone you trust and want to be in a long-term relationship with. On the other hand, if they had a single personality and a consistent voice, but kind of reacted deadpan regardless to the context, that also would feel unnatural and not trustworthy and not someone you want to be in a relationship with. So that's what I'd want people, you know, if I had to, standing on one foot, explain what voice is, what tone is, and what the difference is. And then how to start creating that for your own company. I'd have to recommend a book called The Ultimate Guide to Microcopy by Kinneret Yefrach. And she gives a very nice sort of step-by-step guide on how to start building your own company's voice and tone. And she gives it in a way that you don't need a lot of resources. Small companies, if you're the only UX writer, or if you're, you know, a design team of two and don't even have a dedicated writer, you can still take a lot of her advice there and do a lot with it. It would start from trying to define what your voice is. So you want to speak. Do interviews with executives. What's their vision with founders? They started this thing. Who are they trying to be? Who are they? Things like that. You want to do some market research and look at who your competitors are, what they sound like, what their voice is, and how much do you want to be similar to them and how much do you want to differentiate from them? And if you want to differentiate from them, how? And of course, you're going to do user interviews and understand how they speak. Because remember, at the end of the day, voice and tone, it's about having a conversation. And to have a conversation, it takes two to tango. So as much as you're asking yourself, who are we, you have to know who are they. So this is actually an interesting point that came up on social media a while back with Slack. So Slack is often looked to as a gold standard on the same level as MailChimp when it comes to experts in voice. And Slack has a very witty, sort of cute, friendly voice. And the controversy was whether that's scalable. So even if they keep their voice consistent and their tone appropriate, you would expect someone to speak differently to an audience of 20 people and an audience of 400,000 people. And it could be that that's kind of what's happening with Slack. They're sort of outgrowing their own voice, which is a nice problem to have. So that's, and then after, you know, the small team would figure out what their voice is and how their users sound and what a sensible conversation would be like, it's really going to be a matter of practice. And the most important thing would be to be consistent everywhere. Because again, if you sound like you have a personality disorder, you're going to do more harm than good. And then to test, to iterate, to constantly visit, to, you know, because things are going to change. You're going to get smarter. Your user base will hopefully grow and is likely to change and shift over time. And you need to make sure that your voice stays relevant and continues to express your brand values as they evolve as well.
Since our topic for today is microcopy, what do you consider being microcopy and how does that relate to that big style guide voice and tone document? Does voice and tone have examples of microcopy inside? Is there a separate document that has all your instances for copy inside the app? How does this global vision work together with actual tidbits of text that will go in the UI?
Sure. So microcopy is really any copy that helps the user use the product. So anything that's speaking to the user before they get to the product would probably be marketing. And then once the user signs up and they're in, that would be where product takes over. And that's why you can understand now it includes transactional emails, SMS notifications, and of course, what most people think of, which is the actual screens inside the product. Inside the screens, you have titles and subtitles and labels and drop-down menus and toast notifications and pop-ups and everything else you can think of. All of those design elements are going to include microcopy.
Non-microcopy would be like a blog post type of format or some other marketing.
Absolutely.
And anything else, it doesn't have to be specifically micro short to be microcopy.
Correct. I would say that that's correct. I would say when people say micro, they are usually referring to the short texts on the screens, but UX writing would encompass more than that. It would encompass the other things I spoke about. And I'm actually really glad you asked about long form content. This is something I'd love to clarify for everyone listening.
Yes, please.
Copywriting, okay, that's a marketing role. And copywriting is things like landing pages and Facebook ads. And it is a very admirable skill. It is very difficult. It is very measurable. It's data driven and also takes a lot of sort of, it's also an art form. And it's its own discipline. Separate from that, you have content writing, and that would be the blog posts and the white papers and the longer form, things like that. And then you have UX writing, which is separate. And whether you call UX writing content design or content strategy or whatever you want to call it, it's going to be different from copywriting and from content writing. And this is something that I think recruiters on LinkedIn, for example, really don't understand, but they are different disciplines with different skill sets. And they use different tools and have different aims and different metrics. And so those are two lines I would say you can draw between titles.
I'm so glad we clarified that. That kind of answers most of the questions, but not so much. Like in my books, content design still refers more to that second content level of things. But it's interesting because there is the shell itself, the UX, the interface, and then there is what's displayed inside, you know, the data and possibly the content within the app or within other resources. So that'd be content design. I'm interested. What's your angle on that?
Sure. Again, another question I'm really glad you asked. And I think I have an anecdote that'll help answer it. So I was working recently with a designer and she was creating wireframes. And she came to me with two buttons and she said, and she had placeholder text in there. And she said, is my button copy too long? And I said, absolutely. I can't understand a thing. It's like a whole sentence on a button. And because of the style guide, she was working with all caps on buttons, which I have a separate objection to. But I said, that's completely illegible. But I have a suggestion. Instead of just asking me to fill in the space on the button you've created, why don't you add a subtitle, add sort of a question above the buttons? So instead of one button saying, I'd love to save everything I've worked on today, and the other button saying, forget it, it was all a draft, please trash it, add one question saying, would you like to save what you've worked on today? And then your buttons can say yes and no. And she was like, wow. So this is a really important, like the take home here is that content design is exactly that. It's content and design. And it's designers not asking writers to fill in the containers that they've created, but rather to understand that as much as the content needs to accommodate the design needs to accommodate the content. And that The writer is the one who is an expert on the way people read, on heat maps that show Z patterns and F patterns, and on front loading, and on how size and, you know, arrangement on the page affects the way that people consume words. And that often can involve us telling the designer, instead of two long buttons, this should be a line of text and then two short buttons and things like that. Or instead of this, I was recently given a table and it had no title. And the team thought that that would work because there was a paragraph above explaining what was below in the table. And I said, no, you have to understand that most people's eyes are going to read the title of the pop-up and then skip to the table because it's visually appealing. They're not going to read that paragraph in between. So they need to be able to skip from the title of the pop-up to the visually appealing table and already understand the title of the table without reading the paragraph in between, things like that. So that is what content design is in the world of UX writing. It was actually Sarah Richards who, from Content Design London, who originally coined the phrase content design. And I think she had a slightly different intention for it, which was more long form content. She basically revamped the entire UK government website. And she talks a lot about how content isn't only the words, it's realizing what content, including calculators and video clips and whatever else it might be, is most appropriate to communicate the information. But in the context of UX writing, I always think of content design more as designing how the content appears. If there's an extra sentence here, or if this would be better, not as a button, but rather as a link, things like that.
Yeah, Sarah's definition is probably closer to what I had imagined that being. But that anecdote of yours about taking the question out of the brackets, sort of, using the design methods, it's essentially, in short term, what I do for a living. Just approaching problems from a different standpoint, taking things out of the brackets, simplifying, classifying, I don't know. You can call it many different things, but I'm glad that that can also be taken to the designer from a writer. That's something that I wouldn't even hope for in real life.
Yeah, well, we hope for it. And, you know, Gandhi said, be the change you want to see in the world. So we have to just do our best in our day to day to make these changes a reality.
One more thing about the definition of microcopy. A lot of people don't even consider, you know, let's say the wording for navigation, microcopy. They would think that microcopy are, I don't know, help tidbits around the place or anything extracurricular that's stuck around the UI that's like additional bits of copy, microcopy. That's not the case. Can you please confirm that?
I confirm. It is really everything. It's navigations, it's menus, it's really all of those words. They all need thought. They all have best practices. They all interact with each other in specific ways. And absolutely, all of that is microcopy.
I have so many questions percolating for you. I'm afraid we're not going to fit them, but I will try.
Sure.
So what's a technical implementation for microcopy, essentially? Does it all live in a Google Doc, which I know it does because I read the article, but like after it's implemented, where does it live after that? Because like, it's all right. It's clear how to put together a document for version one and then make it live. But then what becomes the source of truth for all these little things that exist in the app?
So that's a really good question. And because I've worked at startups and also because it's an early sort of early on in figuring out what UX writing is and what it should look like. At this point, it is sort of like a fly by the seat of your pants ad hoc, figure out what works. And there's never enough time for anything. So what has been my process and the process of all those who I know pretty much until now is you get briefed by a product manager on the feature they'd like you to build. The designer starts designing, the writer starts writing. I highly recommend you sit together in the same room at all times, the designer and the writer. And you sort of bounce back and forth. And as you create copy, they plug it into the sketch file so you can really see how it looks. Many things change once you see how it looks. You change your mind, they don't like it, and you go from there. It's an absolute must to see how the copy looks inside the design. And then when my designers have it, an updated screenshot, they actually paste it back into my doc. And that way we keep each other updated and we're also sitting together live until we're happy with how it looks. And also until the screenshots are exactly the same in my doc as in the InVision and in the sketch files and vice versa, that everything is exactly synchronized. From that point, we pass it on to the dev team via the product manager. Of course, this is after any compliance approvals and legal approvals and any other stakeholder sign off that's required. And then you're right. And then sort of, okay, what happens if I go back and want to test that copy later? Do I use the original doc? What's like the sort of the version tracking? And that's a really good question. So I've tried a few things. None of them worked. I've tried going back to the original doc. I've tried creating a new doc that links to the original doc. And honestly, the rebrand we're going through right now has been a fantastic opportunity to really research and practice a more comprehensive, scalable approach, to look at new tools, to look at how we would want the infrastructure to be ideally. It's something I'm thinking about a lot these days. So what I'm doing for now is I've created a sheet, actually, to keep all the text in a sheet. It's sort of hard to describe without showing, but there are tabs and there are, you know, columns. And basically, it's a way to keep track of as time goes on. Like I said, we're doing a rebrand now and I'm literally changing every string in the entire product. So I have this really solid baseline. It'd be really hard to do retroactively. If you don't get in on day one of the startup, which UX writers never do, or if you're not doing a rebrand, it would be hard to start collecting the strings retroactively. But if you do have this opportunity to have every single string documented in one place and then over time to add the new versions without having to override the old, and then to add notes on why those decisions were made, why those changes were made, if it was part of a test, which version won the test, and things like that. It's starting to get out of hand for a sheet. Google Sheets really can't handle all the different dimensions I want to track. So shortly I'll start doing the research to see what tools are out there. If any listeners have any tools that kind of do this, I'd love to hear about it.
Sheets on steroids would be Airtable and Notion.
Okay.
So these are the two that might fit your needs, but they're not copywriting tools. They're global spreadsheet solutions.
Got it. All right. Well, I'll see if they have what I need. And if not, maybe I'll get someone to build it.
I have a few questions in the blitz kind of fashion, so you could maybe answer them quickly. So my biggest pain point, capitalization, your thoughts on it?
Capitalization, there are a lot of trends, there's a lot of research. Right now, sentence case is hot, but doesn't work in every situation. So I'd say the most important thing to do is make an educated decision, do your research, figure out what you want to go with. Be consistent and reevaluate it as the information becomes available, whether that's user feedback or changing trends.
How consistent do you need to be? Could you have, let's say, sentence case, sort of lowercase casual labels for the buttons, but then you would have capitalized headlines?
Absolutely. In the style guide I'm writing right now, buttons will be in title case and secondary CTAs like links and things will be in sentence case. Absolutely. That's okay. You just need to be consistent across buttons, for example.
What about the drop-down menu items? What's your preferred? No, probably sentence case as well?
Sentence case. The preference is sentence case anywhere it makes sense. So for an example, where it wouldn't make that much sense is as table columns. So I have a table and I need titles for each column. And often if you make those sentence case, because most of them are one word and some are suddenly two words, it looks like a mistake on the two word strings.
Who makes decisions? What are the exact labels for the navigation items?
It's Microcopy. So I would be doing that, the writer. But of course, you know, it's a collaborative effort. You have to speak with design about what fits and product about what the intention is and support and sales and user-facing teams about what they think users will understand, because it might be different from what we think it means. So the final call would be the UX writer's call, but it would be after a lot of interviews and research and input from other people.
And same for actually naming the new features, let's say, that you're introducing.
Yes. Naming new features, you would want to collaborate with marketing probably, because even though they're touching on users before they get to those features in the product, they want to sell the features. So you need to make sure you're speaking a language that they think will sell as well.
The blank slate that we see instead of, let's say, a table, but there is no content yet. So how long would you recommend that piece of text to be there, if that could be generalized as a piece of advice?
So empty states should be, like all other microcopy, as short as they can be and still get the job done. So I actually recently wrote an article about why concise shouldn't be one of the Ten Commandments, because there's a lot of writing out there about how concise, 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 the fewer characters, the better. But if that comes at the expense of communicating what we're there to communicate and give the user everything they need to get their job done, so we haven't done it right. So I would say that as quickly and clearly as you can explain why the state is empty and how to fill it, then that's what you want to do. Why the state is empty fulfills a user need. They want to know how they ended up there. And how to fill it is actually your need. That's the brand, that's the business need. Because if it's an empty state, you probably want them to engage and do something to fill it in. So this would be a prime opportunity to get that message across.
Is it okay to include links in those text paragraphs, or does it distract the user from doing what they intended to do? Let's say a link to the help docs.
Sure. So first of all, in that situation, in an empty state, I would start with what went wrong. The next sentence would be what they can do about it. And then absolutely, I would want a button so that they can actually do the thing. But separate from that, Sarah Richards is actually spearheaded project called Readability Guidelines, talking about accessibility, making interfaces accessible to people who use screen readers, for example, and things like that, but also just people who are in a hurry, people who come from a different industry, just making UIs accessible and copies accessible to as many people as possible. And something really interesting I learned from her, and I've started to apply it in my own work, is to make all these clickable links you're talking about at the end, at least at the end of the paragraph, if not at the end of the entire piece of content, because they are distracting. And if you do click on them, you're unlikely to come back to where you were before. And it makes it a lot more readable in general.
And does there need to be a period after that?
That depends on the length of it, the style guide, a million things.
There were a few more pieces of advice that you were giving in your article, sort of most common mistakes and tips for microcopywriting. Could you give us a brief summary of that?
So advice, one would be get a UX writer. Even if you think you can't afford one, I've written and I've given presentations on the ROI and how it more than pays for itself. Other than that, if you are doing it yourself and you don't have a writer, always ask yourself whether what you've written is clear, concise, and helpful. I think that's the trifecta that was put out by Google at the beginning. They were one of the first companies to really get UX writing and really start developing it as its own discipline. It sounds really basic, clear, concise, and helpful, but you'd be surprised how many times it sort of stops you in your tracks and sends you back to the drawing board. Something that you said because you thought it was cute and then you realize, well, it doesn't check the box of helpful, for example. If you can, then you want to check your copy for, like, if you're writing the copy, you might have a very high level of English or whatever else your language you're writing in. So if you can bounce it off a non-native speaker, that helps a lot. Not necessarily because your users are non-native speakers, but because it's simply more accessible for all. Even other people with a high level of that language can read faster and understand more easily. It reduces their cognitive load if it's in a lower reading level. And there are also apps for that, like Hemingway, which I recommend. And it's sort of like Grammarly, except it includes reading level. Consistency, I don't think I can say it enough. Consistency, consistency, consistency. Because, you know, again, you don't want to look like you have a personality disorder. You don't want to look sloppy. You want to look like you have it all together. You're a trustworthy product. There are people who care and who are paying attention behind the scenes. And it also gives you a baseline to test against. If something works better than something else, you can't change that everywhere if you didn't start with the same thing everywhere. And the most basic thing that really anyone can do is read what you've written out loud, even if you look like a crazy person sitting in a room. Talking to yourself. There was a lot of research done. There's a book I cannot recommend highly enough called The Man Who Lied to His Laptop. And it really summarizes in a really fascinating way. It's a really good read about how people expect digital interfaces to sound like people. We're over trying to speak like computers. We want computers to speak like us. So if you read your copy out loud to yourself and it feels unnatural, so don't write it.
I love that piece of advice. And the other of my favorites is check your copy with other people, because as product people, as designers, as founders, any title basically, you get entrenched in love with your product and you might be just making very, very obvious mistakes sometimes. Not in the sense of like typos, but in the sense of that it's absolutely not clear to other human beings.
Right, for sure. You know it so well that you think things are obvious and you take them for granted that they very well might not be.
Yes, totally, totally so. I think you've already pointed enough resources that could be great for bringing yourself up to speed. Maybe a few other books, if you have, for our listeners to self-educate on the topic.
Sure. Not writing specifically, but UX, there's obviously Don't Make Me Think by Steve Krug. That's fantastic. There's Letting Go of the Words by Jenny Reddish, which is, it's a little bit more difficult to read, but it has a lot of, I don't want to call it basics, but if you're just getting started, it's like you need everything she says in there. Yeah, like your baseline is to start and keep that as sort of your textbook. Yeah. And in addition to Kinnaret Yifrach's book that I mentioned, and oh, there's a great one, Conversational Design by Erica Hall. And then of course, Content Design by Sarah Richards. That'd be your like, the first half dozen you should start with.
Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom today. That's super actionable and valuable. Where can people find you and your writing online?
I'm on Medium and Twitter. So Yael Ben David on both. And that's really where I put out what I'm thinking about, what I'm seeing.
Well, thanks again for your time. Thanks again for sharing. And I hope you get a great rest of your week.
Thanks so much. You too.